Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
So, welcome everybody. Those who are about to kill me, Steve helped me on the way here, but I guess we can introduce ourselves. I am Jason Nelson. I am the owner and publisher of Legendary Games, and I also do a lot of work for FISO. I also work a little with the Four Horsemen, their Four Horsemen Open. And not last year, but the year before, I did kill the entire party.
I'm Dan Dillon. I recognize a few faces from the last panels. Nice to see people again. I'm a freelance designer. I have a couple of Paizo credits, Villains Codex, and the upcoming Ultimate Wookiees. I've done some work for Legendary Games, fine people there, Cobalt Press, Rogue Genius Games, Playground Adventures, just kind of a scattershot of third-party publishers. Mm-hmm. Delightful people whose games you need to check out.
Great. I'm Savannah Broadway. I'm a writer, editor, developer. I don't do layout. that, but general, like, what have you. I interned with Paizo and have worked for them, as Dan said, the general scattershot of third-party publishers.
There's the man.
I'm so sorry, everyone.
No, you're fine. Totally went to the wrong hallway.
Oh, but yeah, Kobold, Legendary, Wright Publishing, Playground.
Yep.
My favorite Killer GM moment, just in a nutshell, was I run a Dread game, and all but one of them died at the hands of another player.
That's awesome. That's awesome. They probably had a coming.
Yeah, they did.
I guess I didn't get my idea. Yeah, my very first 3.0 game ended in a TPK against Frost Giant Barbarian. We're talking about killing folk.
Awesome.
That's you.
So do I introduce myself? I'm Steve Helt. I'm on the core rules team for Paizo. I'm a freelancer for them and for several other companies. I'm famous on the Four Horsemen. I'm perpetually late because I do things like go to the wrong hallway. My favorite killer GM moment. I talk up killing PCs all the time because it is fun and I like tough encounters and I like all of my players are insane and make these really crazy guys. So I have no pity for them. But I try to be story oriented and not kill unless I have to, you know. But the first year I won Iron Dungeon Master, I killed my entire party and our whole point was they went to hell and had to buy their way back by doing some favors for people in hell. And so that was the entire story. So our first combat encounter, I try to begin every new stand-up game with combat. And I killed them all during that. And
first encounter?
First encounter, killed every one of them.
You bastard.
Handed them a little thing that says death is not the end, it's just the beginning, because I try to put it, I'm dumb, I put it in a theater quote in most of my adventures. And then they went to hell, did all this stuff, came back, and then they got to redo all of those encounters with a little bit of help from Asmodeus, basically. They just got help from the boss. And that allowed them to survive them and retell their story. So that was cool. The plot of the game.
Making death work for you.
Yeah.
That's you.
Make death work for you.
That's right. That's right. So did we introduce everybody?
Yeah, we're all good.
Oh, gosh, okay.
You're the last one here.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
The penalty for that is death.
So we opened with talking about killer GMs and, of course, killer players. Originally, what we're going to talk about is how to run essentially killer games, right? We want to talk about making sure that your campaigns at home are the stuff of legend. And what's our motto?
Make your game legendary.
Make your game legendary. And so the idea, of course, is how do you run the kind of game that people are just achy? They cannot wait the full week to come and be in a part of your game. They tell everybody else about your game. I was paid the high compliment once of someone told me back before Pathfinder was even a bet. He said, I didn't know Dungeons & Dragons could be like this because he thought my game was really exciting and we were telling a good story. And, you know, we want our hobby to endure. We want the companies to always be doing great. We got a lot of great contributors across freelance lines, different publishers, and of course, Paizo and WotC. And of course, they pay us money, so we want them to be around for a while, right? So how do we grow the hobby and make sure, and the best way that I can think of is that we're welcoming, we're inclusive, those things, of course, are just what it takes to be good people. But also, how do we make the games so incredibly badass that people are just always coming, always showing up, and always telling everybody about it? instead of being afraid of being Pathfinder or Dungeons & Dragons nerds, what if it was just the greatest thing since sliced bread, and we kept selling it positively to everybody around us? The best way to do it is to run an amazing game where everybody has an amazing time. Which is why, when we put the panel together, we took some of the most amazing GMs that I've ever seen in action, and we put them here, which is what these guys are. So, I thought what we would do is we would talk a little bit about some of the things that you do to make your games specifically great, and we'll talk about that for a few minutes. We added killer players to the list, so I thought we'd either talk about how to handle killer players or things that we do as PCs that we're particularly fond of, you know, things that will make everybody's game better. And then I thought, hopefully, if we're quick enough with that, we can open up for questions, and you guys can talk about your specific, you know, I have these players or this situation, and how do I make this a better part of my game, for those of you who are GMs. Or how can I make a game better just by being a player? You know, so if you guys have questions about that, if we open up to that, maybe we'll have some great advice from, not who cares what I say, but what you say.
Yeah, sounds good.
So, let's talk a little about Dan. I'm curious to know, Dan Dillon is one of my oldest and dearest friends, long before either of us ever dreamed we would do game design.
Hanging out at a game store.
And yesterday, we went from hanging out at a game store to having lunch with Wolfgang Bauer and talking about the future of the company and projects and all that stuff. And one of the reasons that Dan became one of our founding four horsemen is because he is such an amazing dungeon master. Having never done design work before, he became a four horseman, really. He is has incredible taste, is really fun. He is not afraid to kick a player's ass. And
Character's ass.
Character's ass. Character's
ass. Oh, you didn't tell them that one story.
No.
He is not afraid to kick a PC's ass, and they love him for it because the combats are always fun, the NPCs are always great and powerful and really interesting. And so, some things that you do to make players love games and keep coming back even though you abuse the hell out of them.
Sure. There's a couple of things. I've been sitting on panels today and everybody's been saying such wonderful, insightful things. And one of them that I want to bring to you guys for that is I love to run challenging encounters, right? So I look at challenge rating and I always, you know, that's it's a ballpark. It's a guideline. I like to push my encounters to the more difficult end of the CR range for a given number. Because that's kind of how I like encounters to be when I'm a player. I want to feel like I have to earn a victory against a dragon, particularly one of those iconic big, you know, big bad end guy type monsters. I don't want to feel like I'm cakewalking through a game when I'm playing in it. That's not fun for me. You know, the story parts of it can be great, but I want a bit of a tactical experience. I want it to be challenging. I want it to feel like I can fail. If I don't feel like I can fail, if I don't feel like I can die, victory just is kind of bland. So I bring that same attitude when I run a game, when I design games, when I build monsters, when I build encounters. I tend to push a little bit on the more difficult side. And maybe that's not the best for newer players, and I can recognize that. But I want to give them the opportunity to do great things, but I want to make sure they have to earn it. So a lot of that comes from knowing the players and the characters in your game, which is much easier to do at a home game, of course, than it is if you're sitting down to a convention table with people you've never played with. Be aware of what your players' strengths and weaknesses are. Play on some of those weaknesses so they have to rely on one another or come up with creative ways to get around it. And know what their strengths are. Sometimes throw things at them that will challenge those strengths so they can't just use, like you have a one-trick pony character, like a buddy of mine back in 3.5 made a pounce, charging, reach, having barbarian with a halberd, right? Yeah, and so, but he would smash the hell out of anything that he could pounce, reach, charge. Anything else, he just kind of delayed and passed every turn. I'll delay, comes back around, oh, I can't reach anything, I'll delay. Well, I mean, that's not cool. So you have to understand what they're capable of, and if you're going to play to their strengths, understand that if you build encounters that that completely bypass their strengths, they're not going to have a great time, and they're not going to be interested in playing that character anymore, and maybe not playing in the game anymore. And that's not what we want. That's kind of a bad challenge, if that makes sense. So I try to design challenges that are tailored to the party, that they can overcome, but they're going to have to work for it. And I don't fudge dice to save characters' lives. That's just not how I do. That is not how I came up. One of my long-running old second-end GMs, Skyler, he was merciless. murder, you know, he rolled in the open, he didn't fudge dice, he didn't roll behind a screen. If you got critted three times, you got critted three times, and you made a new first level character. So that's kind of how I came up, and so I don't like to kid glove that part of it. But I don't push for that, right? I'm not here to kill players, to kill characters. And I'm not here to kill players' characters and make sure they don't have a good time. You know, you want to keep them coming back, but you want them to earn those victories. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that I focus on when I run games.
Jason?
Well, I wore my Zykon Order of the Stake t-shirt because I love the quote. Sacrifice companions. If there are any problem it can't solve, never let your villains be alone. Now, sometimes you want to have an iconic one-on-one fight because that seems cinematic. Unfortunately, in a role-playing game, it's not a cinematic one-on-one duel because it's 4 or 5 against 1.
Action economy is a bitch.
The action economy will dogpile the strongest person so that either they are so untouchable that the party has no hope, or they are reachable and crushable. So that doesn't necessarily mean you have to surround them with an army of minions, though you can. It means you have to operationalize the battlefield in an interesting way. That can mean the environment itself.
Yes.
That can mean the geometry of the situation. That can mean using illusions and deception. Basically, you're getting the party to waste their resources in some kind of a way. Now, I should be circumspect, as one of my players is sitting right here in the front row.
Be vague.
So, yeah, just seriously, you don't want your party to be able to just completely gang up. And this is something we addressed, and one of the things that Legendary Games published a lot of his stuff to do with the Mythic rules for Pathfinder. And in some ways, I'm just going to step back for a second, there are interesting ideas in 4th edition D&D. Wow, I tried the system, didn't know, love all of it. There were parts of it which were interesting, and some of that is dealing with minions, some of it is dealing with brute monsters, some of it is dealing with solo monsters. They acknowledge the issue that you have to build monsters a little differently depending on the role you want to fulfill.
Yes.
And taking a little bit of a cue from that, but also how the Mythic system worked, we actually put out a couple of books that were specifically, and I thought I had in my bag and didn't. One called The Path of Villains, one called The Path of Dragons, which really are built to help you create situations for your villains and your dragons to be prepared for a lot of the things that your heroes could do. Look, you can fudge anything you want. It's all behind the screen, right? But that's not very satisfying. And
certainly not to get caught.
Right. I roll in the open, and the dice fall where they may. I have no one to whittle in my old age, but characters getting crushed and annihilated first time they played was a common occurrence. Joel here can attest to the fact that, you know, I murdered my own son's character, you know, several times, including once when he was in the bathroom and his character was hit by a dragon.
Oh, no. Killed while you were at the table.
Was that not true?
Oh, very true.
That is the second story I've heard about someone being eaten by a dragon while in the bathroom. Must be something about it.
We don't leave.
This is why published adventures don't have bathrooms, because yeah. Nothing good happens.
You guys have while you're bathroom.
But the Mythic rule set, even if you're running a standard Pathfinder campaign, really provides an excellent framework for allowing you to enhance your villains and your bad guys in a very systematic way. And in creating Path of Villains, we looked at the tropes of villainy in movies, comic books, literature, and trying to think how are ways that we can structure this so that your villains can figure out ways to come back from the dead, have pre-planned escape routes, be able to counter things that the player's doing. They can equalize the action economy, that when the players use their various cheating ability against them, they can counter-cheat back. How they can, you know, forge packs with demons, and all that sort of thing is built into it in a regular, systematized way, so you can build that out within your villain and feel like you're at least following a certain set of rules and a certain set of order, so that it's satisfying and not just arbitrary.
Right.
The same kind of thing with dragons, because they're the iconic solo monsters. You don't necessarily want to have a dragon and an army of little dragons. So, that could be fun. But if you do want to have that one mega monster, cool, but you have to understand how to counteract what the players are going to try to do, and to really build up the kind of things that are the weak spots and to buffer those. Everything Dan said about knowing your players is all true, because you need to see what are the specific tactical advantages that you know that the characters in the campaign in your home game will have. If they've got your Rage Lance Pounce, however barbarian, it's okay for the players to be doing, you know, to be good at something. Right. So, sure, send some cannon fodder up there and let the barbarian grind them. That's fine. But don't just set your dragon right in the middle of Main Street.
Because you'll die in round four.
Because that's going to set yourself up for failure. Playing your monsters with some intelligence. If it's a dumb monster, fine. Play it dumb. But if it's a smart monster, play it smart. And use the geometry to your advantage. I wrote a number of adventures for Pudge for the Adventurecraft line. One was called The Hungry Store. And some people complained about that adventure because there are three different places in there where the dungeons are vertical. And so you can't just run, you have to climb or fly. Well, there's a windstorm coming down. One's a giant ice crevasse, it's 800 feet deep. And there's dragons that can come out from either side of it and drop you to this giant crevasse. Well, that's too hard. It's supposed to be hard. It's supposed to challenge you to think differently, too, let you not just rely on your trick. There will be plenty of times that you can charge and reach and pounce and slaughter and murder everything in front of you. That will happen. But break up the structure of your game so that there are at least numerous occasions where they have to deal with challenges for which they are not ideally suited.
Right.
Savannah?
I would say that one of the strongest things in your toolbox as a GM to keep people coming back is to give them enough agency to feel good about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like my favorite phrase as a GM is, how does it die? Like, for whatever reason, people, and reasonably so, I am too, are very taken with the idea. It's like, okay, so you kill the bad guy. You could just leave it as like, yeah, he's dead, or whatever. But like, have them decide, like, I chop his head off, or, you know, I actually, like, they could let him live. They could, you know, maybe there's some crazy Krynos werewolf, and they, like, burrow through his chest and eat his inside ropes. Like... whatever.
Wow.
I did that once.
Inside ropes.
It was a good time. That's a Daigle original. Inside ropes.
All right. When you say you did that, we're talking about characters, not players.
Yeah, of course. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. But yeah, no, give your players a certain amount of agency in the world and they will love you for it.
That's great.
That's my go-to. Oh, also, props. Props are one of my favorite things. Don't be afraid to ask character or players to make props. But one of the favorite things that a GM did for me, or for my group, was that there was a necklace that was attached to some, or to Wendigos, that's what it was. There's an amulet attached to Wendigos.
Nice.
And he had actually put it in the freezer.
So it was cold.
It was super cold. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to go refresh my drink. And so he comes back and he's like, ah, yes, and whenever you dig up this hole, you find this. And he throws out this, like, leather pouch and we're digging around. And it was, like, slightly frosted over. It was, like, icy and cold. And it was just, I don't know, it was this wonderful immersive moment.
That's cool.
That is really cool. That's smart thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give in just a few seconds what I call the Nick Logue School of GMing. I thought, because of long years and because of players that were pretty happy, I thought I was a pretty decent GM until I entered an event called Iron Dungeon Master at Gen Con 1 year. And then, Iron Dungeon Master is really cool. Just very briefly, you go with no preparation. You're not allowed to use any, like, published adventure material. They give you three elements. It usually includes a monster, a thematic element, and some sort of piece of terrain or physical item. You don't know what those are, and then you have an hour to plan your adventure and run a four-hour adventure for a group of people you've never met. And then they score you based on how dynamic you are and whether or not you really understand the game. And then this thing they call general panache, which basically means anything. Right? Right? The first year that I went, I thought I was pretty amazing, and I wasn't. I left one of the elements out. I didn't do a great job. I was a little bit disorganized because I was so panicked trying to make sure I did a great job with everything. I didn't. But every time that I tried something like that, I developed and I got better and became a better spontaneous GM. And so elements that make me a really good spontaneous GM are things that I learned from Nick and from that experience that I think also make me a better table GM whenever I'm motivated. You know, when you work 12 hours and you're half an hour late for the game, you walk in and you say, guys, I didn't plan anything for this week, so what kind of trouble do you want to get into? That's different. But when you get to a game, and now I can handle that sort of thing a lot better than I used to be able to. When you get to a table, how many of you are GMs, like regular GMs at home? Thank God. Oh. Bless you people. And how many of you are just players and here with the GM? I hope he doesn't learn anything. Okay. So listen, one thing that I do is first, I try not to. It's very difficult, especially after a long day at work in your regular home campaign. I try never to really sit down. I always stand up because it brings an immersive quality of energy to the table. I try to start every spontaneous game with some kind of combat or action scene. You notice you go watch one of the Marvel films, you don't go 2 or 3 minutes without there being some kind of action, because we want you immediately bought into what's going on, so then when we give you a plot, you're going to go chase it down, right? The same things that apply to good movies and TV shows, or to even really good novels, right? The best way to start a novel is with action, you know?
You mean I can't start it with "It was a dark and
stormy night"? Don't ever start with "It was." So the things that make you a better GM include adopting energy and transferring the energy to your players, because then they want to give you the same thing that you give them, right? So I try to always stand up. I try to have things that some of you always know, right? Who has like a list of names, just randomly generic names on their laptop or something, and whenever somebody asks you for something, you don't have to think about it because you've got 4 or 5 names already on your lips and you've got a list, so you don't have to go, who cares? When you do that, it automatically, when you don't name a guy, he automatically becomes unimportant. And PCs right. tune out even if they don't think they do. Right? Well, that guy's not very important. I'm going to go back to munching corn chips and finishing leveling because I didn't do it last week. Right? And texting my girlfriend, and then, you know, a few minutes later, they've missed an important detail because you're trying to convey something to them from some guy who didn't have a name. And now they've lost some of that immersion. Immersion is very key, I think very important. Challenge is, of course, super important. And yeah, making your combat with guys, with the big guys, climactic, is super important, right? Because you don't want to have a great campaign that builds up and then you have it just kind of level off or have a kind of a sour note. One thing I also do is I try to keep myself prepared for divinations, and I always try to include an element of prophecy or destiny in the game. Because if you've got 6 players, one of them wants to be the chosen one, at least. Right? Usually it's all 6.
Yeah.
Right? Plus the 2 people who are like, hey, can I come by and play tonight? You're like, no, my table's full, man. They want to be the chosen ones too. Everybody wants their character to be special and dynamic and great at what it is that they do. And so you need, you know, the 3 witches who pass the one eye from one another to tell them how incredible and special and how only they can save the world. You need them to have dreams that tell them about scenes. We play in a Rokugan game that I run. It's called 1,000 Years of Darkness, and it's based on the worst possible guy having a legit claim to be the emperor and then selling out the entire culture to the bad guys. And to do that, I give them dreams. You know, we've got these, what do they call it, Shigenja. We've got these Shigenja, and they are tied to the destiny of their realm that they grow up in, right? And so they have dreams, and they talk to spirits, and the spirits are all like, man, you don't know what's coming. It's terrible. And every one of them then knows that the bad things are going to happen. I create scenes that I'm going to force. This is hard, it takes practice. But I have scenes that I force to go exactly the way I describe it months and months and months before they ever happen. And they have it in some sort of dream or in some sort of vision. Why? Because when you pay it off, you don't have to tell them that they already did it before. You never have to tell them to get it. And every now and then they don't. But most of the time, whenever I had a guy once, he had a vision of a burning building, and a girl he hadn't met yet is laying bleeding at his feet. And he's poised over her, about ready to execute her for her crimes or whatever. And this guy's like a lawful good lion samurai, right? He's not a bad guy. But he's standing over her with this merciless look on his face, and she says, say it. And he looks at her, and before he kills her, he says, I love you. And then he cuts off her head, right? They go through that, and this guy has no romantic interest in the game. He's never had any of that stuff, so he doesn't understand what that vision means until a year and a half later, and I put him in that scene and made him do it. And he did it automatically, and then whenever he remembered the scene before, he was like, you didn't even tell me I had to say that. I just did it automatically. It seemed like the right thing to do. And, you know, it was a great moment. Adding some element of prophecy, destiny, pre-planning, and those things, if you do it carefully, people will keep coming back because it gives them something they want to pay off. And if you want your campaign to be a little bit longer and don't want them to get bored, how many of you have been in, like, an adventure path or something? You go 3 or 4 adventures, and it sort of gets a little stale, and now we kind of want to do something new, and I'm a little burned out, and you know, it's time to move on, right? The moment where we decide that we don't want to get burned out in the game, but we want to pay it off and make it something awesome, that's how we go from a good game to a great game.
Also, you know? Keep in mind, if you want to be really nasty, that bad guys can send your characters dreams, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those dreams can be like, oh yeah, you are totally the chosen one, and you should go over here and do this.
Right, you can subvert prophecy.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's like, oh yes, it's your destiny to go and reclaim this gem from these evil people who took it, and we'll just leave out that the gem powers the shield wall to the palace, and blah, blah. Right. Don't worry about any of that, it's your destiny.
About second or third level, I gave a bunch of guys, and we were experimenting with magic items that get better as they go up in level, you know. Most fantasy systems have something along those lines. This was third edition of 3.5, so it was like the Ancestral Relic, the
Weapons
that sort of
Legacy
stuff.
Too.
Yeah, Weapons of Legacy. And they had a bunch of these, and they were steadily growing as I got more powerful, to the point that at 6th or 7th or 8th level, they were taken for granted. And then I gave them a distress beacon. You got to go into the Underdark below the Forgotten Realms, and you've got to save these people, because there's people who are collecting all the great ancient relics of these old religions, and they want to get rid of all of the good guys and all of their sacred iconography until there's just like no good divine power left. And they're like, okay, well, we're going to go liberate all of these important critical relics of all of the people that, you know, that our gods are friends with, right? So they get to the Underdark, they go in a room, the room is completely coated in anti-magic, and the relics that we were trying to trap were the ones they've been carrying since second or third level. Right? So When you do those sorts of things, you get a little bit of a buy-in, you know, for villains and for how the plot's going to work and all that other stuff. And you try to create moments where players go, oh. And then they may or may not buy you pizza the next week.
That's worth the true goal for
the true goal for any GM is to get free pizza. So you guys may have some questions, and we may delve into those specifically, but I'm trying to keep an eye on the time. That's some things that we do in our games that are longer running games that we want to make your game excellent, whether it involves combat or planning or, you know, the overarching plot ideas, that sort of stuff. What about some things, Dan, as a player, you could do to make a game more epic and legendary for everybody?
Oh, buy in. Be interested in doing whatever the game is doing, right? Nothing sucks worse than the character who goes, why would I go on this quest? Gold? I don't care about gold. I don't care about the missing princess. I have no interest in this. Don't be that guy. Don't do it. It sucks. Don't be Bob the Reluctant Mage.
It kind of comes from a place of conceit, really, right? We're saying is you need to do something more to gain my interest, because I'm the most important. I'm the star of the show.
Right,
you can't have six of those.
Yeah, no, you can't. So, you know, make sure that as a player, you're talking to your game masters before a game starts. You know what kind of game it's going to be. Build a character that will work as a team to do whatever the plot is doing, okay? You know, obviously, there may be some conflict, and that's fine. You can have conflicting ideals with different characters or with something that's going on in the plot, and that can make for great drama. But be willing to play the campaign. Be willing to play the adventures. Make a character who wants to go be a hero and go do these awesome things. Because nothing can shut a session down faster than the, why would we even go this way? This is dumb.
Right. Well, and if you have an idea of what kind of hero you want your character to be, talk to your GM, because myself included, most of the ones that I've discussed with, they really want you to help them build their world.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, if you, like, want your character to have this specific goal, talk to the GM, and they will probably be more than happy to facilitate all of that.
Right.
There was another kind of fourth edition idea with the idea of, essentially, wish lists for treasure, which, in one sense, is horrifically gamist, but on the other hand, is one of the things that your character would think would be cool to find.
Right.
I could throw out 40 different magic items in the treasure.
Right.
But if it all gets dumped in the magic store and you just sell it and go craft your own thing you wanted, then you may as well not even bother. Just give them a, here you go, here is one block of generic universal monetary units. Go forth and make what you want to make.
Right.
So you have to make your rewards as a GM rewarding, something which interests the PCs. So that's a place where as a GM you can talk to your players and say, what are the kinds of things? You don't have to sort of say, I want to, plus five Vorpal Sword, that's great, probably not going to get that, but what are the kinds of things that interest you, which would be cool to find, and that can help you to see things and replace things that, and even if you're using a published adventure, you don't have to use what's in the book, you can tailor that and work with that. So,
you're good, no, that's perfect. Building in rewards that tailor to the player's interests and the character's backstories, that creates a lot of that investment. If they know that they're suddenly questing for this lost sacred bell of their faith that is said to grant the wishes of the faithful who ring it, you know, suddenly, oh, well, now this person wants to go on that quest because that they said they wanted to find a sacred artifact. That would be a cool item to find. Well, now you have tailored a plot to hook them in and drag them along this quest.
Right, and if the bard, you know, wants to have some, like, personal rude be like, ah, well, your evil twin is also, you know, out to, you know, destroy this bell and,
right,
you know, blah, 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 like, make the evil twin do the thing.
Right.
So that's another thing also, which, by the way, is make the world dynamic, which is things happen when the PCs aren't on screen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If the dungeon is sort of sitting there in, you know, frozen animation mode until the players walk in the door, after a while they get the sense that, you know, nothing seems to be happening here. But if you, that's the difference between a villain and an obstacle.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the great monsters of, you know, classic mythology and stories aren't villains. They're just a problem to be solved. A villain is somebody who has their own plan, their own motivations, and their own desires, which run in some way contrary to the player. A villain really is an antagonist. A villain is somebody who's trying to do something.
Right.
So in the sense of creating plot movement that is relevant, it really helps the players be able to see that things are happening when they're not there, and so they can't just fart around and, well, we ran through our spells the first two encounters, let's go back and rest. All right, next day, well, we ran two more encounters, let's go rest again. Because the bad guys are proceeding with their plot.
Yep.
Now, there are some people who feel that's a little manipulative, and that's okay. Because it can be overdone if you do it all the time.
Right.
But at the same time, it also lends a sense of dynamic realism to the campaign. I ran a game years ago in Forgotten Realms. It's a long campaign. And the players at one point, you know, unleashed, you know, the spirit of sort of this ancient evil wizard, which they didn't realize at the time. And they kind of farted around and kept adventuring and kind of did a little this, did a little that. Meanwhile, villains were off doing their own thing. There wasn't really a direct interface. They could have found out more about them. That's not the direction they chose to go. And eventually, it was supposed to lose strength and, in fact, conquer the world.
And it's all your fault.
Yeah.
The pieces were stuck in time, and eventually they woke up 500 years later. You know, basically they've been mounted up as a museum exhibit.
Good.
I love it.
Good.
And I mean, it used to be one of the characters in Asimar, and basically in the second edition campaign, they had sent off basically a signal flare to an Asimar, you know, to like their divine patron, ask for divine intervention. So after they wake up, you know, a few rounds later, this, you know, Agathion or Archon or something shows up and says, oh, hey, we have this old ticket. Basically, did somebody here call for, you know, tech support, basically? And, yeah, this has been sitting around. Like, and the ancients trying to find out what the deal is. And like, wait a minute, where are we? And how? Yeah, it's been 496 years, 17 days since your request. And they're like, whoa, timeout, what? At the end of session four, everything stops. Yeah. And it's like, what happened? Did we win? Did we lose? You'll find out next time. And so then they were able to find out what happened. And in the end, of course, they were able to triumph. And all was right with the world. Although the world was changed by the action. So when the next campaign picked up, it picked up 100 years later. And we called it After the Fall because the Forgotten Realms was very different now,
right,
because of what had been done in that previous campaign. So if you allow the world to move and let the players see the world is moving, then it's not just that guy's always ahead of us. But if they find out there are recurring villains and recurring characters who are pursuing their own agendas, they may realize, oh, time is a finite resource and we need to do something. There is a certain countdown clock on some things, and it also encourages them to work to find out more. Like Steve said about divinations, whether it's a prophecy or just, what the heck's going on out there?
Right.
I see these signal flares out there, but what do they all mean? What do they add up to? You give them information. One thing which I've occasionally tried to do, and I don't do it anymore because I'm old and don't have the energy I used to, is essentially like a campaign newsletter.
Oh,
almost like kind of a little monthly news report. Here are kind of events that your character will hear about. And you could set up as rumors they can pursue, or it could just be, hey, here's stuff that you guys learned about the world. And so, even if you just send, you know, a couple of bullet points, you know, every so often, you know what, that can be something which can help engage your players in the world. But besides that, I didn't want to go back to a little bit about your idea of characters. You think about superhero teams, and that's probably what your player characters are.
Yeah.
Batman works great on his own, but Batman is also part of the Justice League. Wolverine is a lone wolf, you know, to the extreme. But he also works as part of the X-Men. Does he argue sometimes? Does he chafe against the authority of other people in there? Yeah. But fundamentally, he's also all in on the concept of the team.
Right.
And he will, he's headstrong. He wants to do things his own way, but he's also bought in
right.
to the team concept. And that is important as a player to make sure that even if, you know, that's your personality, you're going to be the gruff loner, you know, being a dick is not a personality. Running off on your own is not a personality trait.
Making
stealing from the rest of the party is not a personality trait. You know, realize it's a team game, and that whatever your personality is, you need to be invested in a team and move the team forward.
Yeah. And I would say, a big part of that is right. Kind of the opposite side of being a GM and granting agency to me is seizing agency. Mm-hmm. Right? As a player, I am absolutely 100% proactive. I have NPCs I want to go meet. If you will not name them, I will name them if that's okay with you. Now, I'm an obedient player. If a GM says, no, Steve, you can't do that. Steve, you're taking up too much time from the other players. That sort of thing. I want everyone to have a really good time. Usually when I play, it's because I'm too busy with my day job or with Four Horsemen Design or whatever to be a GM. So I'm a little bit distracted anyway. I sometimes am designing archetypes while everybody else is getting to play and have their turns in combat. So, you know, I want to make sure everyone else is having a great time as a player and making sure that they have time to be focused on, to be great at combat, that I'm not so good at everything, that we don't need them, right? But also, I want NPCs that are paying attention to my character. I want my character to have a plan and an agenda and to work that agenda, right? Because if I am asking for that agency, if I'm asking to be involved, I'm hopefully driving a plot. Right. I'm giving good, well-developed villains something to respond to. And generally speaking, I'm helping fill holes in the campaign. A lot of times, a published adventure path doesn't account for what happens from one adventure to the next, because that's kind of hard to do, and it's really a GM's job at home to help make those transitions smooth from one adventure to the next, right? Adventure to the next, right? So if I am in a sandbox-type game, and the sandbox is full of me just out there playing in the sand along with three or four or five other guys, then the adventure never really ceases. And there are other things that can happen. The villains can decide to take advantage of enemies that I have made because of certain friends that I made, or because of certain actions that I've taken, or because my alignment differs from theirs and I'm imposing my will on, you know, the city that we're in, or whatever. So I find that it makes a game better to make sure that all of the players are proactive, have their agenda, are serving their church or their guild or whatever, you know, the cause of peace or justice or vigilance or whatever it is that is important to each individual character. And if I am role-playing a character with integrity, then I'm doing things to make everyone around me more like whatever it is that my vision for the world is, and so is everyone else. And that makes for, I think, a much better game, because the GM doesn't have to constantly come up with NPCs, doesn't have to constantly pull some motivation out of me. One of my most frustrating moments as a GM is whenever I try to describe a situation and I've described a dire need and there's a villain out there and I know what the PCs like or want, and then I say, so what do you guys do? And they're all just like, well, you know, I don't really know. I'm going to let somebody else take the lead on this, and we're just going to go do what they do or what they do. That never happens in a game where I'm sitting at a table. I don't always have to take a lead, but I swear by sweet Odin's beard, if you don't, I will. Yeah. And the reason is because it's supposed to be a game where things happen. If we're just munching pizza and corn chips and talking about sports and checking our emails instead of actually playing the game, you know, it's not a great game, and I'm not helping make it a great game, you know, as a player. So we've got about 20 minutes left. I thought whether it's on the player side or praise, I say Odin a lot because I've got this Norse thing lately. I don't know. But praise the fictional deity of your choice. Most of you are GMs. If you guys have questions about situations you've encountered, games that you have at home, things that you want to do, or how we handle them, please go ahead and ask. We're going to start with the guy in orange because he raised his hand first.
Specific question about how to fix encounters that you want with certain monsters when certain PCs tend to just dominate that. I have an entire storyline built up right now that's culminating in a lich. And they're going to go fight him in his lair and all that. However, most of my PCs are just going to attack it as normal, do their thing. One of them is a paladin. He's going to steamroll through it on his own with no one helping, as he's done with a few monsters in the past, but not a big bad such as that. How would I keep the kind of lich encounter with a few undead and that sort of thing, without everyone being like, okay, we'll take care of the additional people, paladin cord, go murder the thing in three turns, because that's your job.
Good. Let's do this. First, what's your name?
Connor,
okay. So when we do this, so we can get through as many questions as possible, how about we have Connor, you ask, and then one of us will just take a question.
Okay.
And then we'll go on to the next question, unless somebody really wants to jump in.
Right, you gotta go. I repeat, minions, especially a lich, and minions don't have to be just speed bump minions. Minions should be, essentially think of it as an evil character party. So, the minions should be something which can realistically challenge characters and can inconvenience them in ways. So, think about the tactics your character likes to use. And think of minions that don't necessarily have to be undead either, that are good counters and good foils. So, perhaps the lich has several iron golems, and they're the ones, and perhaps they're even awakened iron golems. Something like that,
iron
which
golem
are
rogues.
Not evil, so the paladin can't necessarily use this stuff, but are good roadblock and can counter things that the paladin does well, in a way, well, similarly, undercutting his strength. Paladin still has defense abilities. I mean, shoot, you can smite and get your AC bonus versus the lich if it's going to attack you while you're fighting the iron golem, if you want. But think of alternate minions so that everything's not all one type.
See, I would suggest a bone golem because they look super undead, but they're not even a little, and
they're just
gonna be mowing through them. They're like, look, it's for your skulls. I'm gonna channel the harm, and nothing happens. I've been that cleric. It's a sad day. It's
a
very sad day.
Mounted combat guy, spirited charge.
No, he is a halfling paladin of vengeance with 3 levels in Unchained Rogue.
Of course he is.
Okay, first, yeah. I like him.
He's that guy.
All right.
All right.
All right. So who's a good, let's go with you right there. What's your name?
Philip.
Hey, Philip.
I have one of those guys in my campaign right now, and my problem is they're in a magocracy, so very powerful and very squishy casters tend to dominate our villain lineup, and he's all melee all the time. And I loved your advice about minions, which I've used, and still dropped a sorceress twice his level that I've been building for like 3 sessions by himself, no other party members, 3 rounds. Part of that is he's got 4 years of experience on me, and he's constantly calling me on, oh, that's going to provoke. Oh, she can't cast if she's doing that.
Bold person.
Fear.
So Phil, the first thing I want you to know is you're not alone. Like, we've all been through those situations, especially as we grow as GMs, where somebody's just a little bit more seasoned with the game than we are, right? It still happens. I mean, I can write on the core rules team for Paizo and still screw up a rule, because there's so many rules. Or, just frankly, sometimes there are just rules that I haven't got around to reading yet, because I haven't made time to be able to do it, right? I mean, I wrote most of the spells in Ultimate Horror, or Horror Adventures, whatever that book's called. And I haven't read all the spells, including the ones that I wrote after they right? So you're not alone. Growth will get you past part of that issue. Another thing is I believe it's important. Some people, the opposite side of not always knowing the rules is I believe it's important to experiment with the game and become expert at almost every phase of it. And because when you say really, really squishy casters, I have a tendency to build casters that are nowhere near squishy. And because I like them and because I'm kind of expert with them, I know what some of the rules are. And I don't like characters with glaring weaknesses. I would rather be the second best at everything instead of just unapproachable at one thing. And so over time, you'll get there. The thing where they point out what's going on in combat and all that stuff, some people can be irritated by that, but I almost never am. I mean, I try not to be that guy whenever I'm a player at the table, but I want the game to follow its rules. I think Dan agrees with me, the rules of combat are important because they're how we continue to tell the story, and they're how we don't screw up things even worse in the future. So try to look at that always as a growing experience. Okay, so now I understand attacks of opportunity better. Attacks of opportunity, grappling, whether you're playing 5th edition, 4th edition, Pathfinder, 3.5, 3rd edition, or whatever, those can be confusing because there are lots of corner cases and all that other stuff. You know, what provokes cover? You know, whenever I emerge from a doorway, who can hit me and who can't? You know, there's an attack of opportunity. All that stuff is a part of being and understanding the game. And if somebody understands it better than you, just learn from that person.
That said, there is a line. Like, there's definitely time like, you know more than me, that's good, we can have a teaching moment, but there's also jerks. I don't know what side you're character or your player falls on, but there are also people who are just jerks, And there's also, this is not the panel to talk about, but there are proper steps to maybe not play with that person if they are, in fact, just a jerk.
Well, one thing that I like to do is I like to pull, whenever I get to a place where I feel like a combat is actually better described scenically, I will I have no compunction about taking it off the map. Now, I don't mind being on the map. I love the 5-foot square, and I'm pretty good at running a combat in three dimensions with countdowns and all sorts of nonsense because I have had to acquire those skills over time. You know, when I first started, I would be terrible at handling any part of that, much less all of it. But don't be afraid to pull the combat off the map, and then nobody can nitpick. Well, that provokes an attack of opportunity. Well, but no, this guy over here can flank. You also remove the temptation for people to tell other people how to play.
So
don't be afraid to go scenic with combat until you feel like you've developed a little bit better with the rules. And when it comes to building the characters, I say build tons of them, contact people that you like. You can always reach any of the four horsemen, you know, Mir Dan, or you cannot reach Tim Hitchcock on Facebook or by phone or by text.
Or by carrier pigeon.
By carrier pigeon.
Smoke signals have some success, but have to, you know, the curvature.
It depends on the
kind
of smoke. But you know what you can do is you can make sure that you reach out and gain mentors who are better at running combats in the game than your experience allows you to be until you grow up to that point. You could say, you could send me a message on Facebook, or you could go talk to people at your local game store, and you could say, man, how do I make a sorcerer that just does not get squished in two rounds by every paladin?
Isn't there a sorcerer bloodline that means that you don't have to use somatic components, and then you don't risk spell failure for wearing armor?
Anything that you want is out there. It was still third edition. It wasn't 3.5 with some of the changes. It wasn't Pathfinder. It wasn't fifth edition. I built one of my first famous characters from third edition was a wizard lich by the red wizard. By the time he was 12th or 13th level, he was a lich, and that dude was just a badass in hand to hand with touch spells, or he would drop pretty serious damage on you with a dagger, or he was fond of, you know, quicken, fly, improved invisibility, and then two fogs next turn.
Yeah.
And that dude is not squishy.
And don't be afraid to multi-class your characters. Like, yes, it's a mage
obviously. Good advice for him.
Oh, yeah, bit of advice.
Sure.
For you. Yeah. Quick.
Can I finish what I was saying first?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't be afraid to multi-class. That wizard who's good at touch spells can also have a couple levels of monk in there, and you can punch people with touch spells as well as tap them.
That's true.
I lost a bit of advice. You said you've been building the sorcerer for a couple sessions. Mm-hmm. Is there any reason why the sorcerer wouldn't know the tactics of this party? Your sorcerer can learn, if he's got spies or anything else, learn the tactics and the characteristics of his opponents. Don't be afraid to use it against them if you can find a valid reason to use it against them.
Sure.
Because for one campaign, we kept doing the same tactic. Final battle, they prepared for that tactic, we didn't use it.
Mirror image and hallucinatory terrain will solve that problem.
Yes.
That you had. Yeah. And it'll solve it forever if you do it one time. Let's go all the way to the back.
I have a player character. I consider myself one of the more well-versed people in the rules of my playgroup.
Sure.
I'm the constant GM. And I have a player character who, for the most part, rivals and or is on par with me when it comes to the rules. The problem that I run into is metagaming based on certain abilities. He did this, so that must mean this is going to happen, so this means if I do this, I can get this, which means this is going to happen, so combat over. How do you stop a player from metagaming abilities in such a way that you can pull the wool over their eyes?
What's your name, sir?
Steven. I apologize.
Steven. I'm also Steven, so we're cool, right? Are you left-handed?
Even Stevens.
No. Well, never mind then.
So the first thing is, a certain amount of metagaming is essentially unavoidable. There's just nothing you can do about that. Like, at some point, you can tell one of us the levels of an NPC, and we can tell you pretty close to exactly what they can do. And that's just how it is. Particularly when we've been running games, we know what monsters are, we know how they work, and we can kind of fudge it. Oh, I've never heard of a troll before. How do I hurt it? But, you know,
right. Yeah.
We know, right?
The answer is rock trolls.
Yes.
you hit it with fire, it doesn't get
a quick and easy answer to that is reskin things.
Yes.
Don't tell them it's troll. Describe it as something completely different. Use the stats of a troll. Don't tell them it's a troll. Describe it differently like they've never heard before, and then they won't be able to figure it out. Right?
Have a sorcerer dressed up like a druid.
Sure.
They just happen to have a pet panther that, you know, follows them around, or...
Exactly, yeah. You know, don't necessarily tell them what an ability is, just describe its effects. Don't say he's going to sneak attack you. Say, oh, you know, he stabs you between your ribs and you're bleeding now and you take this much damage. You know,
it's probably a good point, place real quick. I know this is a little bit conceited, but Dan and I worked on a book called The Talented Bestiary, and you can find it. It's actually will be available in print, POD, so hopefully really, really soon. It was a really successful Kickstarter of ours. We're really proud of it. It is literally a book that creates a new system for reskinning monsters from the ground up, where you can give it any abilities you want.
Right.
If you want to, and the book itself comes with some 230, 250 reskinned monsters from the bestiary, plus some new ones that we created.
What's the name of that in here?
It's called The Talented Bestiary. Okay. It's from Rogue Genius Games. It's called the Genius Guide to the Talented Bestiary, and it's got the Four Horsemen logo on it. It is literally a system exactly to combat what you're describing,
right.
And it also has some players' options and some other cool stuff in it. So we tried to make it pretty well-rounded. What that book will do is allow you to create literally any creature you want that you can conceive of. At least I haven't had somebody tell me a concept that they want yet that we haven't been able to put up with.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. The Mythic Monster Manual and the entire Mythic Monster series for Legendary Games does basically the same thing. It's like, oh, it's a troll.
Right.
And it's a, what the hell is that?
Quick and dirty, reskin, change their abilities, don't tell them exactly what it does.
Okay.
Yeah. Describe, don't tell.
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for
thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.